Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I hope I can clarify. I'm not sure that will be true, but I'll do my best to try. In fact, Edith's lecture was fantastic as an overview of a variety of different mechanisms of epigenetic inheritance. And my interest in this stems in part from an increasing interest by evolutionary biologists in general about the role that epigenetic inheritance and more generally non-genetic inheritance might play in the evolution of a variety of different traits. And so I'm going to focus on non-genetic inheritance rather than epigenetic inheritance. And by this, I really mean anything other than the inheritance of DNA sequence variation. So there are allelic variation. There is allelic variation in populations, and these are inherited. But there are a variety of other things that are inherited as well. Methylation patterns, of course, or some other biochemical molecules or other possibilities, but culture is another one, obviously. And I want to try and use mathematical theory to develop a way to understand the evolutionary consequences of non-genetic inheritance in general. And really the power, I think, of developing mathematical theory for these sorts of things is to try and see the general processes that lie at the heart of all these different forms of non-genetic inheritance. Methylation patterns being one of them, but maybe we can understand all these different kinds of non-genetic effects in a common kind of mathematical language. So in a sense, actually, because I can't clarify its importance in evolution, because we don't really know its importance in evolution at this point, and that's obviously an empirical question, what I can do is I can begin to explore the potential effects of non-genetic inheritance in evolution. And so in a way, really, what I'm going to talk about here is a giant thought experiment. It's motivated by some empirical information we have in a bunch of different systems, but really what I'm going to do is illustrate a kind of theoretical approach to account for these forms of non-genetic inheritance, and then ask a bunch of what-if questions. What if this sort of thing is happening? What kind of evolutionary outcomes, what might we expect that are different from what we would expect under standard sorts of evolutionary models? So what I'll do in my talk is I'll start by giving a bit of background, basically starting with the modern synthesis and our current view of how evolution by natural selection works, and say a bit about how a colleague and I, Russell Bondurianski, is the person I've been doing a lot of this work with, how we've extended these sort of standard ideas of evolutionary theory to account for various forms of non-genetic inheritance. And then the main content of my talk will be to go through four different sort of thought experiments, hypothetical examples. One involving adaptation in epialleles, a problem in evolutionary biology known as the Lec paradox. Another interesting area in evolutionary biology that involves what's called a peak shift, and this will involve some ideas of gene culture coevolution. And I'll finish off with some ideas of how there might be interesting interactions between inheritance of genetic variants along with non-genetic variants. So I'll start with this idea of the modern synthesis. The modern synthesis is a term that was first used in this book by Julian Huxley in the 40s. And really, what the modern synthesis is now is really kind of a culmination of a bunch of ideas that involve how we think about species, how we think about speciation and inheritance. And this kind of developed over a 10-year period of time. But from the standpoint of what I'm going to talk about today, the main content of the modern synthesis that I want to focus on is really this idea here. It was kind of a reconciliation of the ideas of natural selection, evolution by natural selection, and Mendelian inheritance. And that seems like a bit of a weird thing to need any kind of reconciling today, because we know that they go together perfectly naturally. But remember, at the time these ideas were being developed, we didn't even know what the material basis of inheritance was, the genetic component of inheritance. And so part of what the modern synthesis did was it showed that these two things, Mendelian inheritance, is not incompatible with evolution by natural selection. We now know what the material basis of inheritance typically is. It's the inheritance of, genetic material in a general sense. And so we now have a nice sort of mechanistic underpinning for the view of how evolution works that was developed in the modern synthesis. We've got DNA and the inheritance of DNA, by and large, that underlies the inheritance that's typically Mendelian, and natural selection acts on these variants in a way that we can now understand quite readily. And so as a cartoon for how we sort of think about, or how the sort of prevailing view of how people understand evolution by natural selection under the modern synthesis is something like this. We have, let me go back, I guess I didn't mean to do that. We have a population of these little cartoon blobs are meant to be individuals, and the different colored chromosomes are meant to represent genetic variation in the population. Some of those individuals survive or maybe reproduce better than others, and so we have natural selection acting, and as a result, there's a difference in the frequency of these genotypes after selection has acted. And then we have reproduction, and reproduction by and large occurring by sort of Mendelian rules of segregation. So again, by and large, although there are exceptions, there's no change in the frequency of genotypes between here after selection has acted and what the frequency of those genotypes is in the offspring generation. That's Mendelian inheritance by and large. And this is a kind of idea that's really at the core of how we understand evolution right now. And a nice example of that, I think, is this study that was published by the Venter Institute a couple of years ago now, where what they claimed to do was generate the world's first synthetic living organism. And what they did was they took a bacterium and they annotated the DNA sequence. So they figured out what the DNA sequence of that bacterium was. Then they had a bacterium without any DNA in it, and they reconstructed a DNA molecule from knowledge of that DNA sequence and inserted it into the bacteria and ended up with a living organism. And so the claim being that the information in the DNA alone is enough to tell you what you need to know, enough to construct a living organism. Everything that matters is encoded in the DNA. My interest in this problem of non-genetic inheritance sort of stemmed from interactions, as I said, with a colleague, Russell Bondariansky. And this is a table of a variety of different kinds of patterns of inheritance that are mediated by things other than genes. And our interest in this really stemmed from this growing pool of examples of different kinds of inheritance that appear to result from things other than genes. It's not always clear what they are, but they do seem to be things other than genetic material. And you don't have to worry too much about the details of anything in this table, but one of the arguments evolutionary biologists have given for why we don't really need to think about non-genetic inheritance as an important sort of central component of our understanding of evolution is that all of these different mechanisms are really just that. They're very different. There's a whole wealth of different things. There's no universality to these kinds of non-genetic mechanisms in the same way that there is when we're talking about genes. Everything kind of has genes of some sort, but you know, some of these mechanisms work in this species and different mechanisms of non-genetic inheritance work in others. And is there any way we can have a general kind of theory of this non-genetic component? And that's really what Russell and I wanted to do, was to capture all of this different variation in non-genetic inheritance in a single kind of evolutionary framework, if you like. And the way we do that really is, as I said, we view everything that's not genetic as a non-genetic component of inheritance. And so we have DNA, for simplicity here, genetic material, and then we have everything else. And I'm going to call that, I flip-flop around using different terms because I don't know a good term for it, but I'm going to call that complement in my talk here today. So it's what complements the DNA to give rise to an organism and to produce the phenotype of that organism. And that might be RNA, that might be patterns of methylation that are adhering to the DNA itself, it might be some aspect of culture, it's anything other than the DNA sequence information itself. And so I'm going to view any form of non-genetic inheritance as complement. And of course, all living organisms inherit both genetic material from their parents and complement of some kind, partly cellular machinery, biochemical constituents, but cultural things and other aspects of non-genetic material as well. And so the claim, of course, is that a complete evolutionary theory should account for both of those things. Since there is inheritance of both of these things, we ought to account for both of them in the evolutionary theory. Now, in a sense, nothing I've said is controversial. Everybody agrees that you inherit genetic material and other stuff from your parents, but that doesn't necessarily mean we need to worry about it in order to understand evolution. And this is one of the arguments that's often given for why we don't need to worry about it. If, by and large, every individual has the same complement, the same non-genetic stuff, then really, from the standpoint of evolution, all we need to understand is the genetic component, because that's all that varies from one individual to the next, and so that's all that really underlies any phenotypic variation we might see. And there's, of course, a taken to the extreme, there's a simple argument why this can't be the case in general, and I'll just return to that Venter Institute experiment, where they took bacterial DNA and they put it in a bacteria, which is the complement, everything other than the genetic material, to produce a living bacteria. And the sort of obvious absurd extreme is if I took mouse DNA and I put it in that bacterial complement, then by that argument I should get a mouse. And we clearly don't have that happening if we were to do an experiment like this. So at least at that extreme level, it isn't the case that all individuals have the same complement. And of course, there's variation in complement that's now well understood, even at the intraspecific level as well. So at least as a general argument, this can't be, this isn't true. There are differences among individuals in complement. And so that alone, at least, is not an argument not to include it in an evolutionary theory. The other argument that's often given is that a lot of these aspects of non-genetic material are ultimately encoded by genes. So, you know, patterns of methylation might be determined by genes at some other locus. And that's meant to be reflected here in these pictures where I have a black chromosome and the complement is black, a blue chromosome and the complement is blue, and so on. Again, that's not an unreasonable argument, but I'll show you in the last example of sort of a thought experiment today that in general, this isn't a good reason not to include it either. And that's because there isn't necessarily a perfect association between the genes that an individual carries and the complement that those genes code for. And as I said, I'll show you an example of that, a thought experiment example, as the last example I'll consider today. So again, as a general argument for ignoring it, that's probably not a reasonable one either. At least that's my claim. And so the broader view of how we ought to think about and model mathematically, model evolution, is something like this. We have genetic variation represented by the different colored chromosomes, and we have variation in this complement represented by the different colors within the blobs. And there may be some covariance between those two. They may be blue tends to be associated with blue more often than not. But natural selection will act on this combination, and it will result in some of these guys surviving or reproducing better than others. And then there will be patterns of inheritance. And the genes will typically be inherited in a Mendelian way, by and large. But the complement, of course, need not be inherited in a Mendelian way because it isn't a Mendelian component of inheritance. And on top of that, it can be induced by the environment, as Edith showed us some examples as well. So there can be environmental influences that change this complement and can be transmitted potentially from one generation to the next as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay out the mathematical structure of the model that of the way Russell and I have gone about trying to incorporate all of these different kinds of non-genetic components into evolution. And throughout the rest of my talk, there are going to be these two things. There'll be G and H. G is the genetic component, and H is the non-genetic component. And I want to keep this as general as possible. So G might measure the presence or absence of a particular allele of interest. Or it could be some quantitative character, like body size or something like that. Same thing for H. H might be an indicator variable that indicates the presence or absence of methylation at a particular spot in the genome, or it may be some quantitative character as well, some aspect of culture, say. And what I want to do is track the evolutionary dynamics of the averages of these characters in a population over time. Now, standard evolutionary theory has loads of examples of models of this sort, and they all kind of have this same general flavor. The evolutionary change in the character, if it's genetically determined alone from one generation to the next, is just the genetic variance in that character multiplied by the direction and the strength that selection is acting on that character. So there's a selection gradient and a genetic variance, and then there's one other piece that arises from the possibility of non-Mendelian inheritance through things like meiotic drive, or also mutational bias. So there's the possibility of another sort of transmission bias term on the end here. If we incorporate the non-genetic component, then we get another term that appears in here, and this is the genetic covariance between, it's the covariance between the genetic component of the trait of interest and the non-genetic component of the trait of interest, multiplied by the selection gradient acting on the non-genetic component. And then we have a completely analogous equation for how the non-genetic component, the average of the non-genetic component, changes from one generation to the next as well. There's direct selection acting on the non-genetic component, and there's a correlated response to selection through any sort of association between the non-genetic and the genetic component in the population. And then this last term here, again, accounts for anything that's non-Mendelian transmission, and that's something that's typically going to be much more significant in the context of non-genetic inheritance than in genetic inheritance. This term here is typically zero, whereas this is where all of the stuff involving induction by the environment or other aspects of non-Mendelian inheritance work. And the evolutionary dynamics of the two are coupled because of this covariance between the two, because the selection gradient can be a function of both of them, and because this transgenerational change, the mutation, recombination, induction kinds of stuff can also be a function of both of these components. And so what I'm going to do is I'll go through these thought experiments, these four different examples that are specific instances of this general way of trying to understand the evolutionary consequences of non-genetic inheritance. And so I'm going to go through an example involving epialleles first, and we'll get to these other ones shortly. This is probably the most detailed example, and it's an example, again, that's closely related to something that Edith talked about. And I'm going to talk about some interesting work that's done by Hopi Hoekstra and colleagues on the evolution of coat color patterns in mice. And this is work that was done at field sites in the southeastern United States. Here's Florida. And I'm going to oversimplify the story, but the general idea here is the ancestral mouse, which is this guy here, occupied the sort of inland areas, and then it colonized the beach areas on the Atlantic coast here and on the Gulf coast here. And as it colonized these things, there was the evolution towards lighter coat color. And what Hoekstra and colleagues have done is study both how selection is operating in these different environments, and then they try to pick apart the genetic mechanisms behind these changes in coat color. And you'll see, of course, there's quite a bit of variation in coat color, but by and large, everything on the beach got lighter. And the idea is that on the beach, it's better to be lighter colored because you're more camouflaged against predators, whereas in the inland areas, the same thing is true for having a darker colored coat. So they, as I said, they did figure out a lot of what's going on behind the genetic mechanism underlying this coat color pattern, and they found basically three separate linkage groups that were involved. One of them is a melanocortin locus, which I'll call the M locus for obvious reasons, and a Gooty locus and a Kit locus, again, which we've heard about already in Edith's talk. This is a different system, a different agouti allele than what Edith talked about, but it's the same loci, basically. And all of these things, all three of these, were found to play an important role in these differences in coat color, but I'm going to focus on these two because those are the two that seem to be the most important. And again, I'm going to simplify the story a bit, but by and large, if we just look at the M locus, what they found is there's differences in the frequency of two alleles in these different populations at the M locus. And I'm going to call it a D locus for a dark, an L locus, or a D allele for dark and an L allele for light. And if you look here, these are little pie charts to show you the frequency of these two different alleles. Again, on average, by and large, when you see a light-coated population, there tends to be a high frequency of the light allele. And when we have dark-coated populations, there's a high frequency of the dark allele. That's not always true. Here's one, although this population has gone extinct, but it had a light coat, but apparently no light allele at all. And of course, if you look at these two populations, which I'm going to focus on, this one here and this one here, they have more or less the same frequency of the light allele, but again, there's differences in coat coloration, this one being darker, even though there isn't that much of a difference in the frequency of the dark allele. And that's because there are, as I said, there are other loci that play an important role. And the other one that I'll talk about here is the agouti locus. And what's interesting in this example is that they found no genetic variation at the agouti locus. So if you look across all these populations, they all seem to have the same agouti allele. But what's different is the level of expression of that allele. And in particular, if you look at the beach populations, there's a high level of expression of that allele, and in the mainland populations, there's a low level of expression, for whatever reason. And of course, we don't, at this stage at least, know why that is, because the allele itself is the same in all of these different populations. One possibility is that there's a locus somewhere else in the genome that's controlling expression at this agouti locus. And as I said, I'm going to focus on these two a little bit later on as a sort of potential example of how maybe epigenetic inheritance might be underlying some of this. Let me go back here. Okay, so I'll say a bit about how the interaction between these two loci work in this particular system. And this is true in the other systems involving agouti as well. And the agouti locus is a locus that interacts in an epistatic way with the M locus. And it's a locus that, when expressed, tends to suppress this locus. So in these individuals here, this is an individual that has a low level of agouti expression, and as a result, there's high expression of the M locus. Over here, this is a high level of expression of the agouti locus, and that suppresses the M locus. And what they found, and this is data from Hoekstra and colleagues, so what they found is when there's low levels of agouti expression, so that this allele, this locus is free to be expressed, it doesn't matter whether it's a dark allele or a light allele. The mice are always dark, and you can see that in the data here. There's dark homozygotes and light homozygotes. Everybody's dark here when the agouti expression pattern is low. When the agouti expression pattern is high, it suppresses these alleles, regardless of whether they're light or dark, but there is a slight difference in whether you carry the light or dark allele. It suppresses them, making the mice lighter in general, but it makes it even more so if you carry the light allele. And you can see that in these data. These guys who are homozygous for the light allele are the lightest of all, but even those that carry the dark allele are light when the agouti locus is highly expressed. So there's an epistatic interaction between these two loci. Now, I'll quickly summarize the story that Edith told you a lot more about, because this agouti system has been studied quite a lot in another mouse, a different species of mouse, involving a different agouti allele, and this is sort of one of the poster children of the inheritance of patterns of methylation in epialleles. As we've already heard tonight, there's data to show that patterns of, let me tell you what happens in them, actually. So here's the same kind of story here, where we have an agouti locus that can act as a suppressor to the M locus. One thing that can happen is you can get patterns of methylation upstream from this that suppress the agouti expression and release the M locus from suppression and give rise to a dark color, along with all of these other characteristics that Edith mentioned as well. And these patterns of methylation can be inherited across generations. They can be induced by dietary factors. And so this is the what-if sort of thought game I want to play. Well, what if in the context of that study that Hoekstra and colleagues have been carrying out, if high methylation of the agouti, remember, they didn't find any genetic variation in agouti, even though they found differences in expression. What if that was due to the fact that there are different patterns of methylation? And the beach favors light alleles and low levels of methylation. So low levels of methylation allow the expression of agouti, and that suppresses the M locus and gives rise to light-colored mice. So you get the natural selection favoring a light allele as well as low levels of methylation in the beech populations. And I'm also going to consider the possibility that these methylation patterns are they're influenced by diet, and those patterns of induction by diet are at least partially transmissible from one generation to the next. So the idea in my thought experiment is something like this. This is the same slide I showed you before, but now these guys are dark here because there's methylation that's preventing the expression of agouti in these populations, giving rise to dark coat color. And over here, these guys are unmethylated. And it's this light allele here and here that is favored by natural selection, but of course it's only favored when it's expressed, and it's only expressed in the unmethylated state here. And so what I want to do is imagine a situation where we have the ancestral type here, which is a high methylated dark allele mouse, colonizing the beach and asking what happens evolutionarily over time. Okay, so that's the assumptions I want to make. The agouti allele is normally methylated, and as a result, any mutant allele that's light-colored is not expressed. It's only expressed when that methylation is removed. And I'm going to suppose that there's always a remethylation process that's going on in the production of offspring here. But of course, the pattern of methylation can depend on diet as well. And so I'm going to use this theoretical framework that I showed you before to explore what happens evolutionarily in this situation. So here's the general setup before. In the context of this particular example, things simplify down to a special case. And sort of a nice interpretation of this, the evolutionary change in the frequency of the light allele in those newly colonized populations in any generation is due to the genetic variance in that allele in that population multiplied by how selection is acting on that allele. Kappa here is the probability of the allele being methylated. So it has to be unmethylated in order to be expressed. Only then is it exposed to natural selection. So this whole evolutionary change here in any generation is weighted by the probability that that locus is unmethylated. And then coupled to that, you have natural selection acting on the methylation pattern itself. You have it acting directly on the methylation pattern itself, and you have evolutionary change in the frequency of methylation at the agouti locus as a result of a correlated response to selection at the genetic locus itself. And then this is the transgenerational part here, which is a more complicated beast that I won't talk about. I'll just show you some examples of what happens, and when you explore this model, you can simulate it. You can prove that there are two different kinds of behaviors qualitatively that can occur in this model, and they're behaviors that you wouldn't really expect to happen if you didn't have the non-genetic component of the story in the analysis. So first I'm going to imagine a habitat where there's low remethylation rates happening as a result of whatever happens to be the food substance in that habitat. And I introduce a mouse into that beach habitat, and I ask what happens to the frequency of that light allele that's favored by natural selection. And when there's low levels of remethylation, you see that the frequency of that allele goes up, and it reaches fixation ultimately in the population. It's favored by natural selection, but it's only favored when it's unmethylated. If you look at what happens in terms of the phenotype of those individuals in the population, well, they start off as dark. That's the dark allele. That's what the unmethylated light allele individual would look like, and this is what the average phenotype in the population does. It increases, it gets lighter as well, but it doesn't go all the way to this maximum possible lightness. It stops at an intermediate level. It stops at an intermediate level because even though this allele reaches fixation in the population, remethylation rates are very low. The environment is such that remethylation happens very slowly, and as a result, you reach a selection remethylation balance. So selection is always favoring the unmethylated state because that's when the light allele is actually expressed. And it's remethylated every generation. And so you reach a selection remethylation balance here where you have phenotypic variation that's due entirely to epiallelic variation in the population. And there's no genetic variation in the population at all. The genetic component has reached fixation. If you compare that to a habitat that would have high methyl, say, in the diet, and as a result, a high remethylation rate, you get a very different kind of pattern. Again, of course, the allele increases in frequency because it's favored by natural selection, but it doesn't actually reach fixation in this case. It reaches actually what is a neutral equilibrium. And if you look at what happens to the phenotype doesn't get lighter at all. In fact, it reverts to the dark state, despite the fact that the light allele has increased in frequency in the population. And the reason for this is that because there's high methyl groups in the environment, in the diet, the remethylation probability is very high every generation. And as a result, this allele gets masked by methylation before it can reach fixation in the population. And so you end up with a population that has genetic variation in it in this case, but no phenotypic variation. There's no evolution towards the light phenotype in this case because of the fact that there's a high remethylation probability. And so again, as I said, this is a thought experiment. These are just possibilities, a way to explore how these non-genetic components might affect the evolutionary dynamics of different traits. And this is just a potential argument for why you might get situations where there isn't a lot of difference in the frequency of the light allele between these populations, despite there being differences in coat color. And one of the nice things about this kind of an argument is it makes predictions about what you'd expect to find in terms of the variability in the population. In habitats where there's low remethylation, you would expect to see a fixation of the light allele, and as a result, no genetic variation in the population, or very little, and you'd be at this, you'd have solely epiallelic variation in the population, as compared with habitats that have high methylation. So that's just one possible sort of thought experiment exploration of how these processes of non-genetic inheritance might give rise to novel evolutionary outcomes that we typically wouldn't expect to see under the standard sort of modern synthesis view of how evolution by natural selection works. The second example I'll consider is one that's it's been an interesting paradox, if you like, from the evolutionary literature for quite a few years, and it has to do with sexual selection and mate choice. And so in many species, it's noted that males provide only sperm to females in producing offspring. But nevertheless, females exhibit quite a lot of choice. They go to a lot of effort to choose among males, despite the fact that males don't seem to do anything other than provide what would appear to be genes, because they don't provide any parental care, for example. And so it was a bit of a puzzle. Why is it that females should exhibit this costly, presumably costly, mate choice, despite the fact that they don't get anything back from that choice other than potentially different genes that they might select? And so the argument for why that might happen is that maybe females are actually choosing genetically superior males. Somehow they're looking at males, assessing males, and that assessment, whatever the male is displaying, reflects its underlying genetic condition. And so people constructed mathematical models of this, and what they found is that under reasonable mutation rates, this doesn't actually seem to work. It doesn't work because when mutations are typically quite rare, and when they're rare, there just isn't enough genetic variation in the male trait that could possibly sustain costly female choice. Another way to think of it is if you look at the model for how you'd look at the equations for how you construct a model of this evolutionarily, if this is the frequency of a costly female preference allele, this beta would be negative. Selection would always be acting against that allele directly. And the only way for that costly preference to spread in the population is by becoming associated through linkage disequilibrium with a good gene from that the male is basically giving to the offspring. And this linkage disequilibrium can never build up to be substantial enough to outweigh this negative effect when mutation rates are at their sort of typical low levels. And so that's the paradox. Why are females actually exhibiting this choice, given it can't be genes that they're choosing from? I'll just show you an example of a model to illustrate that paradox more quantitatively. And so this is just a life cycle I'm going to use where we have a population going through a life cycle where we census the population here. We calculate the frequency of these different alleles at this population, at this state. And then natural selection operates on these individuals. They mature. Females choose males. Mating happens, recombination, and mutations are introduced, and then the process starts again. The form of that model, if everything was genetic, looks identical to what I showed you before. This H here is now a genetic component of quality in males, and there's selection acting indirectly on it, there's selection acting directly on it, and there's mutation on it as well. And this is the equation for the dynamics of the frequency of female preference. And you can then ask, when can a rare female preference allele invade the population? When can we get the evolution of costly female preference? And I'll skip the ugly expression there and show you in two extremes, a low mutation extreme and a high mutation extreme, because they're kind of illustrative of the paradox. If we have a high mutation rate, then this is the condition that needs to be satisfied in order for the costly allele to invade. And of course, that can never be true. So when mutation rates are really high, that doesn't happen. I guess I'm doing this backwards. And when mutation rates are really low, this is the condition that needs to be satisfied, where WF here is the relative fitness of the costly female preference allele. And that's something that's less than one because it's costly. So this can never be satisfied as well. And that's the paradox, if you like, in this context. And I'll show it to you graphically here. This is mutation rate, mutation probability, actually, from 0 to 1. And this is the relative benefit of the good male allele. So females are trying to choose males that have the good allele. That's how much better relative to the other allele those good alleles are. And you can see that when mutation is very rare, the black areas are where you can't get the evolution of preference. When mutation's very rare, you can't get the evolution of preference. And that's because there just isn't enough genetic variation in the population to sustain preference. When mutation is really common, again, you can't get it. And you can't get it in this case because mutation is always now scrambling up any association between the good allele that you're trying to have, the good allele that males potentially give to your offspring, and the costly female preference allele. And it's only in this intermediate region that you can get the evolution of preference. So just a couple of trajectories to show. Here's where you can get the evolution of preference, and here's where we expect mutation rates typically to be, and we don't get the evolution of costly preference. That's a mathematical instantiation of the Lec paradox. What Russell was interested in doing, based on some experiments that he had done with a certain fly species, was to construct a model that allowed for the male trait that females females' offspring inherit to be non-genetic. And the idea that he got this from was in some of experiments that he conducted, he found that when he raised males in different diets, despite the fact that they provided nothing other than sperm to the females, the offspring seemed to have different qualities. So they inherited something from their dad that was influenced by the environment of their dad, and it wasn't clear what it was. And it still isn't clear, but we can construct a model that incorporates that sort of effect to explore the evolutionary consequences in terms of mate choice. And so everything is the same as before, and we have this costly female mate preference allele, but now we've got a trait that males can pass on to their offspring, but that trait is entirely non-genetically determined. It can mutate from one state to another. We'll imagine there are two states, but it's also induced by the environment now to sort of mimic this effect that we see in these experiments. So offspring, let me show you the life cycle is as it was before, but now at this stage in the life cycle, offspring are growing here, they're developing, and they find themselves in one of two different environments, a good environment and a bad environment. And these environments have an inductive effect on the trait of the males. They can turn a bad trait into a good trait and vice versa with certain probabilities. So there's an environmental induction component on the trait. Then there's mate choice as before, there's recombination and just random mutation as before, and the life cycle then proceeds as it did in the previous example. So you end up with a model that, of course, qualitatively, in terms of its structure, is the same as it was before, only now, where before this was just mutation that could influence what happened to the male trait, now there's a component of induction through the environmental effects as well. And you can again ask, when can I get a costly female preference allele to invade the population? And in this case, well, of course, in the high mutation limit, it doesn't work again here for the same reason it didn't work before. When the mutation rate is really high, we basically scramble any association between the female preference allele and the good male state, and so we can't get the evolution of preference in that case. But when mutation rates are low, in the low mutation limit, there is a parameter space in which we can readily give rise to, we can readily get the evolution of costly female preference, provided the frequencies of these different environments that males can develop in is not too extreme one way or the other. And to show you the same plot that I had before, this was the genetic model illustrating the Lec paradox. Now you can see you open up this entire part of parameter space down here that allows for the evolution of costly female preference, whereas before you couldn't get the evolution of preference. And the reason is really quite simple. In this model, the only thing that's maintaining variation in males is mutation. And when mutation rates are low, it's simply not enough variation to allow female preference to spread, to be associated with the good allele and to spread. And that's because natural selection is always removing the bad stuff, the bad male genes. Over here, we've got mutation, but we've also got environmental induction. And natural selection can't remove the variation that's induced by the environment because the environment is variable every generation. The environment is fixed with a certain variability, and that variability is then embodied in the male trait every generation. And so natural selection can't remove it. And so it's always got that variation to act on. And as a result, there can always be the possibility that the female preference allele gets associated with the good male state and spreads through the population. So again, an example, a thought experiment again, like all of these are, that shows that if we allow for these patterns of non-genetic inheritance, we can get patterns of evolution that we wouldn't expect to see under the sort of standard Mendelian sort of modern synthesis perspective on things. The third example, the last two will be quicker than the first two. The third example is one that I'll call peak shifts, and this is an interesting example involving gene culture coevolution. And it's part of a more general problem in evolutionary biology that's interested people, theoreticians, a lot, and empiricists to some extent as well. And that has to do how we move from one peak on a fitness landscape to another. And the sort of canonical view of how this problem is put forward is we imagine in a genetic world, where we're not thinking of non-genetic here for a second, we've got two loci. And so there are individuals that can be homozygous, heterozygous, or homozygous for the other allele, so they're diallelic loci, and then this is the genotype at the other locus. And so here's a double homozygote, and here's the other double homozygote, and we suppose that these are two high fitness peaks. This one here is higher than this one, but they're both higher than these. And the idea is if I switch from one allele to the other at only one locus, I go down in fitness. Same thing if I switch the allele at the other locus, I go down in fitness. I need to switch both of them simultaneously to move from one peak to the next. And the question is, how could that ever happen? Evolutionarily, how can I move from this peak, which is lower than this one, to this higher adaptive peak, without somehow having to go through these valleys. I need to somehow have both of these mutant alleles associated with one another in order to get to the next peak. So I want to consider a specific example of that, and it's one that comes from the literature on gene culture coevolution, and it's one that involves, I'm sure a lot of you probably have heard this story, of lactase evolution. Lactase is an enzyme that allows you to digest lactose, and so to make use of milk products in your diet. And expression of this enzyme normally stops after weaning in most mammals. It's now well documented that there is a novel mutant allele, a lactase persistent allele, that appeared and spread during the last 10,000 years or so throughout different regions in the world, concomitant with the spread of the use of milk products in diet and dairy farming and domestication of animals. And this allele isn't at the same frequency. In fact, there are several different alleles, but I'll simplify the story again. And these alleles are at different frequencies in different parts of the world. And this map just shows you an example, sort of a cartoon of this, where light-colored areas are high frequencies of this allele that allows individuals to make use of milk products in their diet after, well, when they're in adulthood, basically. We can think of this in this adaptive peak kind of scenario as well, only now one of the axes is a non-genetic component and the other is a genetic component. So here we've got these two alleles. We've got the sort of ancestral state where we can't make use of milk products in our diet once we're adults, and then the lactase persistent allele here. And then for simplicity, let's imagine coding two different cultural states, one where we're making use of domestication and dairy farming in our diet and the other in which we're not. And we can then think of this in this same sort of peak shift kind of scenario, if you like. And the argument goes that if I was to, so here's the ancestral state, no dairy farming, no lactase persistence. If I was to then switch to the lactase persistent allele, that somehow comes at a fitness cost in the absence of dairy farming. Otherwise, we would have seen the spread of that allele before dairy farming had become common practice. And so this peak here is lower than this one. If I just switch the allele, I don't do so well. Likewise, if I move to a practice of dairy farming, but I don't have the lactase persistent allele, that comes at a cost as well, because I'm then trying to make use of milk products in my diet, and I'm not able to do that. And so we have these two valleys here, and it's really only if I can get both of those simultaneously that I end up on this higher peak, where I can make use of milk products in my diet, and this is actually a much better situation than I would have been if I didn't have both of those things simultaneously. So how do we get from this peak to this peak is the question. And again, we can answer that using the same sort of framework where we have this allele as our genetic component and this cultural aspect of the problem as our non-genetic component. And the question, the way I'm going to frame this is, the higher this peak is over here, if this was really high, then it kind of is intuitively reasonable that it's easier to go from here to here. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask, what is the critical strength of selection, the height of this relative to this, that will allow me to get to that peak where I'm using milk products in the diet and I have this lactase persistent allele? So the structure of the problem is like this. I've got the allele of interest here, and then the complement in this case is this cultural component of inheritance. And I'm going to use this framework that I said before. So H here is the frequency of, average H is the frequency of using dairy or the frequency of dairy farming. And there'll be two parameters that I'm going to show you some numerical results for. One of them is going to be the fidelity of cultural inheritance. So I'm going to suppose that when an offspring is produced with probability tau, it inherits its parents' cultural practices. So it does whatever its parent did in terms of dairy farming as a simplification. If it doesn't do that with probability 1 minus tau, then two things can happen. It can either figure out the right cultural state for its genotype through learning, or it can, and that will happen with probability lambda, or it can mimic what's happening in the population at large. So basically adopting the cultural practice that's in some sense most common in the population. Then you can write down the equations for the evolutionary dynamics of the lactase persistent allele, the evolutionary dynamics of the frequency of dairy farming in the population, and of course any covariance between these two, because there you expect them to be correlated with one another to some extent. And you can ask, what is the critical strength of selection that's needed in order for us to move to that state that we see where there's dairy farming and lactase persistence allele present in the population? And I'll explain that with this numerical example here. So lambda is this probability of self-learning. And so first thing to notice is that except for this point here, as you increase the probability of offspring being able to figure out the right cultural state for their genotype, you decrease the critical strength of selection. You make it easier to go to the higher peak. And that's kind of intuitively obvious, I think. If offspring are able to figure out the right cultural state, then they will always either be dairy farming if they have the lactase persistent allele, or they will not be dairy farming if they don't have it. And so that makes the spread of these two traits together much more easy. So as I increase lambda, the critical strength of selection required is relaxed. It can get over that hump more easily. The interesting thing to notice, though, is you get a pattern of non-monotonicity here in terms of the fidelity of cultural inheritance. If offspring are not very easily able to figure out the right cultural state for their genotype, then having a high fidelity cultural inheritance, meaning from their parents, they very accurately replicate what their parents do, is better. The critical strength of selection goes down. But if the offspring are able to figure out the right cultural state pretty well, then cultural inheritance from their parents is actually bad. It's better to have a very low fidelity cultural inheritance in that case, because you're better off figuring it out for yourself, in a sense, than copying what your parents do in case what your parents are doing happens to be the wrong thing. So again, an example where when we incorporate these non-genetic aspects of inheritance, we can see patterns of evolution, in this case, moving from one peak to another in a much more sort of facilitated way than we would get if it was solely a pattern of genetic inheritance. The last thing I'm going to look at is, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, one of the criticisms is that we probably don't need to worry about this if there are genetically based patterns that underlie these non-genetic traits. And I want to give you a simple thought experiment to illustrate that while that does change things to some extent, it still isn't necessarily the case that we can ignore the non-genetic component. And this is going to be a very hypothetical example where I'm going to imagine there's an ancestral population, which I'll call morph A, that colonizes a new environment that's favoring a new phenotype. Morph A is entirely determined. The phenotype of this individual is determined by the methylation pattern at this locus X here. So the black morph here is due to the fact that we have, a black methylation pattern at that locus. But the thing I want to incorporate in this is that this methylation pattern is actually coded for by a gene at some other locus in the genome. There may be some arbitrary level of recombination between the two, so that's what that's meant to indicate. And then the idea is this colonizes a new habitat in which morph B is favored. And morph B is generated by having a different pattern of methylation on the X locus. So there's no variation at the X locus here. The phenotypic change that matters is entirely due to differences in methylation. But these differences in methylation are coded for by a gene somewhere else in the genome. Okay, so that's the scenario I want to look at. Morphs differ in their methylation pattern at locus X. These differences are coded for by differences in DNA at a single locus Y. So we've got potentially heritable patterns of methylation, but there's also a genetic basis to that methylation pattern as well, in a way I'll explain in a second. And so it's really the methylation that drives these differences in phenotype. And the reason we need to account for the possibility of non-genetic inheritance in this example is because there need not be a perfect association between the gene you carry here and the pattern of methylation there. And this is the assumption I'm going to make in the model. So during reproduction, the methylation pattern that gets established can happen in one of two different ways. With probability 1 minus r, the parent transmits the methylation pattern that it has. And with probability r, the methylation pattern is reset to whatever is coded for by the allele at that locus. Okay, so that introduces some potential decoupling between what's happening at the methylation in terms of the methylation pattern and the allele you actually carry here. And so morph A colonizes a new habitat and it evolves to morph B. And so I won't go through the details of that of the model, but again, you can use that same framework to understand what's happening evolutionarily. The only change, the interesting thing to notice here, is the only way that the allele at that locus coding for methylation changes is by a covariance between the pattern of methylation and the allele. The allele itself isn't under selection. It's methylation that's under selection. And so the only way the allele frequency changes is by being correlated, having some kind of covariance between it and the pattern of methylation. This is easiest to see if I just show you a picture of what happens in a particular instance of this where I've run a numerical version of the model. So here's Morphe. It's got the black methylation and the black allele, and it's ultimately going to evolve up to here to have the blue methylation and the blue allele. And these are two different outcomes, one where there's this high reset probability, so almost always the methylation pattern is reset to be that which is coded for by the gene you carry at the Y locus, and this is a low reset probability here. And the shading reflects the degree of covariance between the two. So when it's dark, there's a strong correlation between the two, and when it's light, it's very weak. And the first thing, the easiest way to understand this is the classical sort of population genetic view of the world. There's a very high reset probability, meaning that methylation is almost never inherited. It's coded for by your genes. And so this whole problem really reduces to one dimension along the diagonal here. I evolve directly along the diagonal from the black to the blue, and that's kind of the standard classical population genetic view of how things work. There's a complete coupling between the genes and the pattern of methylation that's ultimately under selection. Once we relax that coupling and decrease this reset probability, of course, it's the methylation that's under selection, so the frequency of methylation increases very quickly, and there's very little change in the allele frequency that happens because they're decoupled. And then you reach this kind of quasi-equilibrium where there's a much slower evolutionary change in the allele frequency until we ultimately end up at that point. And you can see slowly the color's getting darker, meaning the association is building up as time progresses. And so there's a very rapid and large evolutionary divergence that's due almost entirely to the pattern of methylation, and then this very slow process where we actually get the change in the allele frequency happening. The interesting thing to note is that at the end of this process, if you looked at what's happened and you just see this, you'd think for all intents and purposes, it was really the genetics that was all that really mattered. I ended up with a blue type here that's coded for by blue genes. But really what happened in the evolutionary process is it was the non-genetic component was much more important in the initial divergence and the rapid divergence. And the evolutionary stuff sort of followed along, or the genetic stuff sort of followed along after at a much slower rate. And in fact, if you look at the stability of this population to perturbations, the perturbations are damped much more strongly by the non-genetic component than by the genetic component. So again, a much more hypothetical sort of example. So I'll just finish with this concluding slide to say that, again, the whole motivation behind what Russell and I were doing with this framework is to try and build a framework that allows you to explore the evolutionary consequences of non-genetic inheritance in a very generic sense. So things involving culture inheritance, RNA inheritance, methyl group inheritance, anything that's other than sequence-based inheritance. And to use that framework then to illustrate that by incorporating these things, we can get evolutionary outcomes that are often quite different from those we'd expect to see if we just had a genetic component to inheritance in the theory. And I'd be happy to take any questions.